Okay, Horace, it's been a bit. We've both been occupied in a number of things, but let's get rolling with a SIMCAR 19. I wanted to start by sharing a couple interesting recent events or quotes. The new CEO of Ford was in the Financial Times a few weeks ago and talked about the opportunity that lies ahead, that their forecast is the global automotive industry turnover would increase 50% between 2013 and 2020 from $2 to $3 trillion.
Okay.
He said it's a very compelling opportunity. So I found that interesting. And then at the same time, maybe a little earlier, the longtime CEO of Ferrari was pushed out. And I had been musing on the fact that, and I'm making somewhat of a joke here, that Ferrari lacks an SUV, right? So it turns out the Fiat parent, had some disagreements over their annual production cap of 7,000 cars and the general direction of the company. So Luca, and I don't know the rest of his name right now.
Montezemolo or something
like
that.
So he is out. Mm-hmm. And I just read this morning on Bloomberg that as part of a financial thing, the Ferrari's giving several billion dollars to Fiat, and then, you know, they will do their thing. So it seems like we're seeing the continuation of financialization, and this $3 trillion number is sort of astonishing to me, that the market would grow in dollar terms 50% in the next 7 years. Is that plausible?
Well, there's a couple of questions I would have about that. Number one, where is that money going to be? Is it going to be in the emerging markets, in China in particular? Are they looking at the quantity of cars rising as assuming, in other words, are they assuming a certain price continuation, or are they seeing a price expansion that might occur with people moving up from, you know, lower to middle class? In other words, will they be spending more on cars, or will there be more cars? Or what's the ratio between those two? The facts are that today China is the number one car producer in the world. It's right. The number one car consumer in the world. It's going to, in fact, it hardly imports any cars at all, which is an interesting, I think, policy decision. Probably in consistent with the way Japan and Korea have managed their car industries, essentially in a protectionist manner, and that has been building their industry, but in a symmetric way. That's the problem with that protectionist model, is that you do not allow for business model innovation. You're essentially going to stipulate the way your business, your industry should grow in this perfectly symmetric way to the others. Usually when you have competition, and let's say an outsider who's stronger becomes the incumbent locally, the indigenous production will have to find a new path. And that's where, you know, I think there would have been a great opportunity for China to become a global leader in new production methods, a global leader in new production in new powertrains, but they chose not to. They chose to do a carbon copy of the model that both Japan, which also was a carbon copy of the United States, and Korea, which was a carbon copy of Japan. They've all developed their industries in a manner consistent with the original drafts done by Henry Ford in the 1920s. And this is because people look at the industry not as a source of product or market ideas, but rather as a source of capital or a sink of capital and a potential source of foreign currency if you're a developing country. So it's seen entirely in the financial terms. It's not seen as a job to be done problem. It's seen as something that we need to have to be big boys. We need to have a
big car industry, right?
Yeah, a big boy industry, and that's car industry, and not so much agriculture. So that's what I would ask.
He continued, and they had a little explanation. They said that luxury volumes are expected to account for 10% of vehicle sales by 2020, but 30% of the profits. So that's the game. But you know, you just wonder how much space there is, given all the things we've talked about in any SIM car, for growth like that, both in price and margin. Even the, you know, the Mini Cooper, a brand you're obviously familiar with, there was an article this week that they hope to sell 100,000 vehicles per year in the U.S. I think by 2018, but they're at about in the 50s right now, and you know, they're advertising their small SUVs and you know, all the Countrymen or whatever these things are, and
not much Mini in those Minis. That's typical though. You get a foothold using an iconic design, and then you just become a seller of the same thing that everyone is selling, because you feel like you need to make the numbers grow. And so when Porsche sells cars in the United States, they only use the 911 as a way of getting the brand established, and then they go on and sell SUVs of different flavors. And that's why probably, you know, there's pressure on Ferrari and the other luxury brands to make SUVs. So surely the luxury segment has taken that category into embraced it wholeheartedly. It's not that big a joke, actually. Lamborghini made an SUV many, many moons ago. I think it was called the LM2000 or something like that. It was a ridiculous car, but it came out and didn't do well in the 80s. But now I think we'll see luxury makers, the first of which was arguably Mercedes, even though people think of Land Rover and Range Rover. Those were not luxury brands when they began, right? Range Rover was a utilitarian farmer's vehicle. It was for English farmers to be able to drive across muddy fields.
Empire in Africa.
But the original Land Rover, I'm thinking Range Rover, which was more in the 70s and 80s, began as an upscale or slightly better Land Rover. But the Mercedes G-Wagen, which was a military vehicle that became luxury, had been associated with the Mercedes badge, has meant that it became a luxury product at a time when people thought of them as Jeeps and called them Jeeps. They were, no matter what they were, I remember the early 90s people, Jeep was very upset at the use of the word Jeep to refer to an SUV.
Generic term, right?
In fact, I think the SUV name came about primarily because people were searching for something other than Jeep to use. And so that's how it stuck, even though it's not a very good name.
So let's say you're the brand manager, you're the CEO of one of these companies. You know, is this simply the classic over-serving strategy because you've got these facilities, you have the brand, everybody's saying, you know, Wall Street says, hey, you know, we've got this opportunity, and so we have to create 8 Mini Cooper products, so we have to create 10 Ferrari products, and it's the only way out. You know, there is no, as you say, asymmetrical opportunity for the current brands. It's just
it's a puzzle. I can't say I know the answer to it, but it's like, why is it that you need every brand to cover every category? Why can't brand like Porsche, Maserati be positioned specifically on a single job to be done? And that could be a psychological job. It could be an aspirational job. It's not necessarily a functional job. And why do we need to take each brand and stretch it and smear it all over the place so that it covers every product category, therefore diluting its position as a brand for a job?
Becomes meaningless, right?
It becomes less and less meaningful. So it is this problem of what is a Porsche SUV. What you're saying is, let's let the Porsche badge rub off on that category so that people will spend an increasing... they'll spend more on a utility vehicle. A utility means usually low or moderate price. And so we're going to raise the price by putting the brand on it. And sure, there's engineering. Sure, there's a lot of quality in that product. I'm not taking that away from it. But it's a question of where do you want to put and spread that brand, because this is an industry that you could build a quality Porsche product. Like, you know, I even think that the SUV is not built in the same factory.
No, it's shared with Volkswagen.
Yeah, it's you share a lot of the infrastructure with partners, and you know it becomes really a Frankenstein product in many ways. But it's a struggle to me. Again, as a brand manager, if you were to ask, where should it be? What is its characteristics? What are its characteristics? What are its meanings? And therefore, how do we enhance the meaning of the brand? When you put it all over the place, you detract from it. This is classic also in terms of how Apple manages its brand. They're very careful about it. And it's not clear to me that the brand management role at car makers has been is being well protected, or that role it has sufficient weight in the decision making process because of this obvious
strategy.
Take any brand, even American, like Lincoln, or they've gone down this road already. They were building SUVs for a while. I mean, you might even ask the question, why didn't they do that for minivans? Minivans were popular at some point, so why did they not? You'll notice, by the way, that Cadillac made a mistake by putting its brand on an economy car. This was a time when it looked like small, sporty cars like the BMW 3 Series were going to become the new luxury niche. And so at that time, and I'm thinking late 80s, the Cimarron, which was essentially a Cavalier. No, not essentially. It was a Cavalier.
It was a
Cavalier that had...
Showing your age, your horse.
Yeah, but it had a lot of simply a little bit of glitter on, sprinkled on it. And it was a time when people really thought that I'm sure they did the decision on the basis of competition, picking up share, BMW coming in with the 3 Series, Mercedes coming in maybe with the 190, and then saying, look, we're expanding the footprint of the brand, the luxury brand, into the lower the economy market. And so sure enough, that is that they chased that. And it did a lot of harm. You could also have seen that happen with the Cadillac brand when they try to do a two-door sort of sports car.
The
Allante, I think it was called.
Oh, that one, yes.
and so
showing our age, yes.
So they took a design. No, maybe some parts were, but it was designed by an Italian coachmaker, which is the usual process. You would hire, an Italian designer.
Of course, yes.
And so the thing is that, again, you chase these segments and you think that that's a good thing for the business, but it actually takes away. And all throughout this time, by the way, Cadillac used to mean that it was one vehicle. It was the Cadillac. There wasn't a Cadillac sub-brand.
Right.
So you wouldn't have you know when Cadillac began, it was essential meaning as Rolls Royce. You don't think that Rolls Royce has models, or at least it used to be. They had names. They were the Silver Ghost or the Shadows or whatever they were called. But the thing was that there was one Rolls Royce. There was one Cadillac, and then it became a bunch of Cadillacs, and then it became. So they were all luxury sedans, and then it became Cadillacs that were actually meaningless because they were applied to economy cars, sports cars, SUVs, and perhaps had minivans taken off, maybe they would have made a Cadillac minivan. But then you see the how ludicrous it sounds, and we get used to this idea of a luxury SUV, and we somehow think it's ludicrous to have a luxury minivan. But it just was.
BMW has one. They have a front drive mini. I guess they wouldn't call it that, but it certainly is in Europe. It's coming to the States, and they just announced a 7-passenger version. It's
front drive, so. I don't know what happened with the Model R that Mercedes had, which was the R, which was essentially
short parts with Chrysler. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was a minivan-like product from them. And so Mercedes has been just as guilty. They've gone all the way down to super economy cars, although they kept the Smart brand for the Ultra. It's not even entry level. It's funny. I was speaking with a friend once in Italy, who was explaining that the Smart brand in Italy was luxury, because the Italian roads, especially urban areas, are very small. So small cars are de rigueur. It's like you have to have a small car or a moped. These are the only
options.
If you
want to get around, I agree.
So what I asked them is like whether the Smart versus the Fiat, like the Fiat 500 and the Fiat Punto. The Punto was probably the most popular car, and then I think there was the Uno, and there were several Fiats that were by far the most popular. But when Mercedes came in with the Mini, the Smart. The Smart was positioned as a premium brand because, and it actually cost quite a bit more than the Fiats, and people wanted to be seen in the Smart car as being essentially an upper end of the microcars range. So you know you can see depends on where you are what the meaning is, but of the brand, but still Mercedes, back to them. I mean they proliferated across so many categories that, again, the Mercedes brand becomes devalued as you do this. You don't say, what does it mean? It used to mean that I'm taking the Mercedes or I've got a Mercedes. It used to mean that you had a luxury product that was probably a sedan that had, you know, qualities of you know, absolute reliability, luxury, and class. Now, or same thing with BMW. It meant sporty, good engineering, somewhat speedy, and comfortable at the same time. Same thing with Porsche. They all meant something. And when all of these car makers, which were fairly niche, right? I mean, these weren't, they never really tried to be Toyota or GM. They were you know, happy selling 50,000 cars a year in the United States. Not happy. Let's just say that was not considered that was not considered a bad number.
Niche, of course.
It was not a bad number, but they were comfortable in the industry. They were, as companies, they were healthy because also they sold buses and they sold trucks, and not BMW but Mercedes, I'm thinking, and they had those solid businesses that were cash cows, and maybe if they wanted to grow up into something else, they could do engineering work. Like Rolls-Royce went into engines and eventually split off, and then now they're still making jet engines for many jet aircraft, right? So that was the way, your way forward was through engineering, and so towards more industrial products rather than consumer products. So the question is, again, what caused the shift, and when did it happen that every car maker, every badge, every brand, in other words, had to be in every job? That is the question, right? Why would you want to be there? Is it simply because you got jealous of the Toyotas and the GMs and the Fords, and you wanted to sort of have a piece of that pie that you could stretch there? And I don't know if that's actually it's something that looks good on the spreadsheet, but I don't think that that's long-term viable, because at some point there will be overperformance, there will be saturation, and you're going to have to reassess how you're going to compete, and by then your brand will not be worth as much. And so maybe an entrant who says, okay, you abandoned that niche, you abandoned the fact that you were a sporty car. In fact, we're seeing in the sports car business what used to be Porsche and Ferrari now is being eaten up by many companies, including Tesla, who are saying we have the job to be done of exclusivity and performance.
Right.
And now performance has been redefined around around
the entire experience, right?
Yeah, the experience and the exclusivity and you know, the fact that you're
an app and all these things.
And not just the technical performance, but think about it, you know, from a luxury point of view, you're saying that I am establishing myself as an innovator, as an individual, because I'm using a novel powertrain. Or even, you know, I was in California yesterday and I was meeting, or the day before, I was meeting with folks, and they had a 500e, an electric Fiat 500.
Oh, sure.
And they had the means to buy anything, but they wanted to put themselves,
in that space.
Yeah. So that's happening in California. Is that if you wanted to hip and rich people there, you don't think about getting an exotic a gas guzzler. You think about getting the exact opposite. You think about small electric, or even if you're going to go big electric, you go with Tesla. So that is getting stolen from the brands. These guys chased the minivan metaphorically and ended up losing the sports car and the core business that they're in. That's what's most likely going to happen.
Yeah. So let's go back farther in history. It's astonishing to me that we are at this point. And especially with the Ferrari news, when you think about what General Motors did, right, back in the 20s, you know, with the brands. I mean, that was Sloan's strategy, was to have slice and dice the market, all these different brands. And it is completely flipped on its head these days. And I wonder if I have a hypothesis that it's because of the strong dealer channel. That, you know, the last time we saw... before Tesla, a interesting, let's say, retail experience attempt was Lexus in the States anyway, where Lexus said, oh, you know, when you come in and get your car serviced, you'll have coffee, you'll have a nice place, it'll give you a loaner. So they were starting to address the experience aspect of car ownership. But since, other than Tesla, nobody has really tried, well, I should take that. In the late 90s, Ford attempted to buy their dealers in Indianapolis. And that was the idea, that they would take over the retail experience. But they ran into all sorts of state regulations and all that. So essentially, my hypothesis is that they've lost control largely of the retail experience. And therefore, that they're left with is stuffing product into that current channel. And again, hypothesis, but maybe.
It's an open question. Why? Like I said, it's a puzzle. I don't know why they would do this. Financialization is really a question. The broad stroke picture of financialization is that people optimize based on financial metrics, not necessarily on the customer. As the principal thing you need to optimize is
the experience, right?
But also the idea of creating a customer, creating preserving that relationship with the customer, and then the jobs to be done in the secondary point of view is to say you could optimize your business around. You say I'm hired to do certain things, and I'm going to do them as best I can, and become a monopoly in that job. That would be a strategy that a business could be predicated on. But when you have a financialization view, you're saying that you're going to optimize around something mythical called shareholder return, and so that becomes the driver for all your decision making, and that just simply means you're going to run off a cliff. And so that's potentially why companies get disrupted, because they don't. They think as soon as we grow up, we're going to be actually professional about things and create maximum value, which means you optimize around the wrong things. So why it happens and how it happens in particular industries, so in the auto industry, this need to somehow maximize some ratio, which, by the way, is then indexed to management compensation. So they yes. You know, Once you index it to and it's indexed also to the dealer channel. I think that partly it's chicken and egg. I mean, how much is the dealer driving that decision, or how much is the management sort of like reinforcing the dealer's business model? There's a lot of mysteries, and I think you need a lot of domain understanding, and you need to really study this carefully. To be able to answer that, but I'm only we're in the business right now, sort of plucking at those pieces of data and seeing and making observations on them, and then correlate is sort of in a sense doing a correlative analysis, but that's not nearly causal, right? So that's mm-hmm. only for us to see, to get informed and ask the right questions. And so the right question for the auto industry today is exactly this: why is brand being devalued, and why are companies motivated to destroy their brands?
Exactly.
This is the question. I think that question would only be asked if you were looking for this pattern of product proliferation over service on jobs and so on. So it's a wonderful topic, and I really would love feedback on what people think is the cause. And let's be careful when making these. You know, we can always throw ideas like, you know, it's some person who's being a dummy. And the problem with that theory, again, is that why are they all doing it at the same time? The consensus is that let's all be stupid simultaneously. It would seem, right? So it's unlikely that they're conspiring for that purpose.
It's interesting, which will lead into the next sort of tangent on this subject, to consider the retail strength in light of what happened in the computer industry, right? You know, there was sort of a retail channel, and then Dell came in with direct, and obviously then Apple decided to go direct with their own. Gateway had done it earlier, although Gateway didn't really have the cachet or didn't see it through, but it's fascinating to me to see these changes in other industries.
Yeah, but the computer industry, the good thing about the computer industry is that it lives in much shorter cycle time, so we can observe it like a fruit fly. And the car industry seems to take forever to make anything
change. Yeah.
So what happened in the PC industry from the 1990s till present is, although generally the architecture stayed fairly constant, what we ended up with, both in sense of Moore's law making it possible to cram a computer into a small form factor, and batteries and screens kept getting a lot better, and memory and storage increased exponentially. So as those things happened, the packaging of the product changed, and therefore the way it could slot into our lives changed. You know, it went from one computer per company, one computer per department, one computer per desk, to one computer per person, or even more than one per person. And that progress only took 30 years or so. So it's you know, the Macintosh just celebrated 30 years, and remember what it looked like. So it's to me, that is, you can argue that technological change allowed the industry to evolve deeply and change deeply in terms of what the basis of competition was. You know, going from something you buy from a salesperson or from a direct salesperson to something you buy on the phone, to something you buy online, to something you buy in the store dedicated to that, yeah, in the salon. So that buy experience changed because of the underlying computer change, and also the experiences, because it's also a platform product. So the innovation that went into what it is came not just from the maker, but from those who added on top of the maker's own offering. So that explosion in software meant that the jobs to be done could actually stretch infinitely. What the car business, you know, has evolved very, very much more slowly in terms of technological change. It's dependent on infrastructure called roads, which once they were built to a certain degree, let's say to the interstate highway system, they've completely stopped evolving. And so, you know, and by the way, networks have fed the computing industry, and networks came from, you know, no networks to token ring to TCP/IP, sure, and then consumerized and then mobilized. So all of that stuff happened, or cellularized, mm-hmm. and all of that stuff again happened over 30 years. And cars, I read a great book, and I don't know if I've sang enough of praises of it. And by the way, it was on the recommendation of Steve Crandall that I did this, and he finally got to it, and I read the Big Roads book.
Oh, sure.
And the Big Roads book is was an epiphany. I mean, absolutely essential reading to anyone who cares about cars is to understand how roads came to be what they are. Because if you study cars and don't study roads, you're not just missing half the picture. You're probably missing 80% of the picture. And
you'd
also,
only
by
have
the way,
Jeeps otherwise, right?
Yeah, but it's also, by the way, if you don't understand roads, you probably don't understand cities either, and you don't understand how we live and how we have come to live the way we do. It's an absolutely essential reading that the transformation of the entire nation of the United States and eventually the world from something we cannot explain to our children anymore, like what was it like in 19th century, or what was it like at the turn of the century versus today, a huge amount of that was the roads. It gave us the retail segment that we have today. It gave us the way we live. It gave us the suburbs. It gave us malls. It gave us every single thing that we are accustomed to, and it's become a fabric of the life, has been delivered by the road, not so much the car. The car created the demand for the road, and once the road was built, the car was tweaked a little bit to make it compatible with the road, but almost the roads were crucial. I could go on and on. We should have a whole show about the roads, right? and the fact that, and also the way people perceived them. They were very hungry for roads in the early part of the 20th century because they had more cars than roads. And now they became cynical. I mean, people became cynical and actually anti-road later on because the roads brought with them a way of life that maybe wasn't too disruptive to communities, especially roads or I should say the superhighways entering into cities. Superhighways were demanded by people because they needed to get rid of congestion. But they went the bureaucrats. The price was less important. It was a huge cost, and it overran as always. But the point is that see what the book lays out is how the heroes of the story are those people who, those bureaucrats, or I should say, at the beginning they were simply men of engineering, or they just knew they took a scientific approach to the problem. They began with data. They began by measuring how people drove. They designed the roads. By the way, while I'm on the subject, I've been watching because my son's a huge car fan. So I've been watching. I ended up finding online on YouTube these Russian car crash videos, and it's a whole genre because in Russia, it's common to put a camera in your car, and it's common because you can't get your insurance. You can't get a payout in case of an accident unless you provide evidence. And there seems to be very little. Trust in the word of mouth that people may have disputes and so on. I can understand that. So what? As a result, though, that all these dash mounted cameras have been recording a lot of accidents, and it's not that there are more in Russia. I think there are more in Russia, actually, but on a per mile driven basis, maybe not on an absolute basis because there's a lot more cars and drivers and miles driven in the United States. But on a per mile, I think it's quite high. But the thing is, when I began looking at these videos, what I instantly recognize once you read the book, what you instantly recognize is that a lot of the problems were with road design, that the roads were designed and built at a time when there weren't as many cars, or they were much slower, or they were of a different configuration, like mostly trucks, let's say, or lorries, or the thing with the roads in Russia is that you see the types of collisions you get would normally be avoidable if only the cars were or the roads were built differently. Case in point, there's a large intersection where you have essentially multiple lane boulevards, and these these boulevards are do not have turning lanes, so that there is no clear this lane goes into that other lane when you make a turn. So things have become very quickly congested and very quickly also chaotic because people are turning over each other. So the point I'm making is that this was
like
sorted.
Boston horse.
No, but it was sorted out on a sort of a standards basis in the 1920s and 30s in the United States, and you read that you read in the book they actually took statistics of all the collisions and they had classified them into these types and these types. So one thing that they said we cannot have is if you have a major thoroughfare and it's fairly high speed, you cannot have an intersection where people can join this highway from a standing start. So you cannot put businesses by the side of a high speed road. You cannot have places you turn in and out. And some of the oldest roads in the country, which actually are in Boston, you still see that effect where basically it was either undivided or a fairly and these are like Route 9 and other parts of the Boston area that you still see when you drive by. You see old businesses like looking like they were built in the 60s or something like that, and so the point is that they worked out how to avoid collisions based on the pattern and the psychology of driving. And it's something that now we take for granted, that you don't expect to hit a car that stopped in the middle of a road, especially a highway. And if it does happen, it's a catastrophe. It's like it becomes a collision of dozens and hundreds of cars potentially, and it's just anyway.
Yeah. So I want to swerve back a little bit into the this business of the retail channel sort of
swerve. I like swerving.
Yes, right. Especially if you're driving the right car. So the other news that came up maybe a month ago was Warren Buffett buying into the retail car business. And my hypothesis, because I'm slightly familiar with another aspect of his business, is that he likes regulation. So, he's big in insurance and a variety of – and newspapers as well. He bought a number of newspapers over the last decade while they were sort of going down. Newspapers have this sort of odd – in the States anyway, this – odd legal framework where they can jointly operate with different brands and share overhead and profits. And so even though newspapers have been hit significantly by the internet, there's still many of them that are making a lot of money. And now he's getting into car business, which is...
It's interesting. I really, Warren Buffett is a genius investor, because I think not because he invests in growth businesses, but rather the opposite, that he invests in mature
yes.
businesses, which are typically, because of disruption, I think become undervalued because they become distressed almost. They are thrown away. Think of it as a business.
Right.
The business simply says if it's not booming, then it's worthless.
Right.
And when you have a boom bust mentality, then you tend to throw away anything that isn't booming. And so what you can do is do very well to pick up those businesses which may be in their sunset stages, but they have plenty more to deliver to in terms of returns, and therefore are good businesses to own. It's let's put it in the small business context. It's like saying you get all dazzled by the fact there's a new mall in town, and then you assume that every mom and pop shop and every restaurant is going to go out of business. But in many cases, people actually will, because of the patterns of traffic and because of the patterns of wanting to find something more unique, and there's plenty of life left in main streets. In fact, sometimes malls begin to try to duplicate Main Street type of dynamic. And what happens is municipalities will often then rejuvenate a Main Street by providing parking, which is usually the constraint that keeps people away. And so you see how then value can flow back to the established business. So you can pick, as a Buffett investor, you can pick these gems that have been discarded. And the industries, which again, I think because he would read an industry like railroads, which he invested in,
yes.
or soft drinks, or even IBM. And you would say,
utilities, you would say
people are missing the point here. This is a reliable business, steady cash flows. I get how management thinks. And, it's like Omaha. You might say a place like Omaha is...
Careful,
is,
horse.
Well, exactly. I know exactly what I'm going with this. It's,
no, I know.
It's like saying the Midwest. It's like, well, if it's not the 1930s and it's therefore Detroit and or 20s, and I should say 30s wasn't that great, but like 20s and then again the 40s,
right,
when the industries were booming, that's the place to be. And people migrated, not just capital, but people moved there. And then they fell into decline. I can tell you this because I live near Lowell, Massachusetts, which Lowell, Massachusetts was
right,
one of the first industrial towns. It was actually built in the early 19th century. So, at a time when the U.S. was mostly covered in trees. So they started building an industry, a town, because of the river that provided power. It was before the steam age even. And so that town went through booms and busts, but then you have this process called gentrification, which means that that young people who might want to live in a urban area are finding places which, like Brooklyn, New York, like parts of, I'm sure, San Francisco are getting gentrified by people who have more money and say, well, we're going to go into these areas that have been beaten up. And what I'm saying is simply that the Buffett model is to pick up on the gentrification trend for businesses. Now, having said that, is it something that indicates that that's going to be a growth industry in the future? No, I think that Buffett's investment model, it says that, well, we're happy with 2% growth as long as that company continues to generate solid earnings. So in other words, 2% industry growth can still lead to above average best performer in that industry growth. So there's they're not playing the game. There were lots of investment games like the junk bond era when you were making essential bets on the deindustrialization of America and the breaking up of,
sure, splitting off the real estate, selling off the pieces, all that.
Yeah, you could make money by breaking businesses up. Or the conglomerate era when you were making money by integrating businesses,
right,
putting them together. And Buffett's investment thesis is that you can still make money from undervalued, solid core brands that, as he puts it, have a moat. But I wouldn't apply his method of value. Value definition or value identification to an industry which is in distress or is being disrupted, because he simply says I have a great instinct for picking undervalued stocks, but he knows he has no capabilities of spotting the next big growth.
This is why he doesn't invest, but he
refuses to invest in technology,
right,
precisely because he doesn't have an instinct for that.
Right.
So that's great. It's just important not to see these as contradictions. That the Warren Buffett is not a contradiction to the Mark Andreessen who's 100% focused on startups and totally ragged edge type of investment, and they both can succeed. So it's important not to see a Buffett investment in a part of the car business as indicative that it's going to be booming. All he's saying is that I'm picking up pieces here.
Right. So now let's turn into a couple other pieces of data recently that point to the looming disruption, right? We've obviously the purpose of a SIM car, and one of them was a bit of data from Japan that I saw a couple weeks ago from the Ecomo Foundation in Japan Times, and they reported that the number of Japanese individuals registered for car sharing services had gone from 6,400 in 2009 to 465,000 in January. So 5 years, quite a bit of growth. Mm-hmm. And the number of cars had gone from 563 to just over 12,000 in that same period. So there's one thing, and we've talked
about car sharing in Germany too. By the way, I was in Seattle also a few days ago, and there was a car sharing. I saw a smart car on the road parked on the street. I said, "What is this?" They had stickers on it all over, and someone pointed out that that's a car sharing service owned by Mercedes,
right,
rolling out in Seattle, and that had already been. And I had heard about these things in Europe and Germany in particular, so I was not surprised. It's interesting how they can pick where to roll these things out.
Well, Minneapolis, I think Mercedes has 200 cars right now.
I think I've seen maybe even, is it Austin, Texas? And so that's another trend, I think. But again, what we have to study these things as is that they're point solutions for point problems. So in urban areas, I think that there's a logic, a solid logic to the car sharing business. And so, but we have to be careful about extrapolating it because of the way roads are and because of the way we live in a spread out fashion like this, enabled by roads and cars. It's hard then to say, well, we need these car service ideas are the way of the future, because the car service will work for urban environments. But let's see how far that can go, because you'd have to, for that to replace the current model, you would have to have people migrating again. So in other words, that will not work. The car sharing model would not work for suburbia. But you could say, well, suburbia is over and finished. Well, not so fast, because it's not easy to make that leap, because again, once you've set roots down, as people have by buying houses and by belonging to communities, it's hard to uproot. In fact, it's easy to uproot from an urban environment where many people are renters to move to the suburbs, and that's exactly the process that highways enabled in the 1950s. There's a great story, by the way, in the book. Irving, Texas was like a tumbleweed to town. There was no one there. And suddenly the highway came, and then boom, it became a suburb, and now it's become a city. And so you have now people in that city think that they are, you know, landed gentry, that, you know, they're lords of their domain. And so it's not easy to say, oh, well, you know, downtown Dallas is going to be booming. Everybody move back. No, it's not going to happen. So that's the problem with the model, is that it's great because you have, and the same thing, by the way, with Uber. I'm tempted by Uber, deeply tempted, because I think Uber has this potential to shift the focus away from vehicle ownership to even driverless cars. I think this is a driverless car. You're just not the driver, and it's someone else. I don't know. The question is always about scale. It's whether a service model of a vehicle or transportation as a service can scale to the infrastructure we have. So to answer this categorically, you'd have to answer the following questions. Will people move en masse from a suburban model? Will roads actually get torn up? Because as long as roads are there and are funded, right, there's negligible cost to preserving the current infrastructure. One way to say that a city disappears or is ghost, becomes a ghost town, you'd have to somehow affect it through transportation change. So ghost towns became ghost towns when the roads bypassed them, and they became ghost towns when the railroads stopped going through there. And so transportation was essential to redefining the economic balance. It's not the only thing, obviously, but if you take the roads away, then the city shuts down. That's how it's going to happen. And so, what, again, this goes back to the question, you have to study the roads as much as the devices that ride upon them. And that's the thing, is that the roads have a whole different dimension, a whole different dynamic. They have There's questions of funding. There are questions of ownership. There, by the way, for roads to have been built, this is another thing you get from the book. For roads to have been built, the right-of-way had to be purchased. So the government had to go in and buy land and tear down. Often if there were urban areas, they had to tear down giant sections of towns, meaning buildings, historical sites, cemeteries. There were many issues about where to lay out a road, such a massive, you know, massive construction on what is essentially a downtowns. You had roads going in through downtown areas, and we have the legacy of that in Boston, legacy in San Francisco, actually, because in San Francisco, they stopped what was going to be an elevated highway connecting the Golden Gate Bridge with the Bay Bridge.
Right.
And that road...
Well, I know. They knocked it down after the quake, yes.
They knocked it down because they said... But they wanted to have it right on the waterfront.
Right.
It was logical. Waterfronts had become, by the way, very, very depressed areas by the 1950s because the you know, they were places where ships would dock, and that shipping business moved to you know, containers and
intermodal,
and so the waterfronts in Baltimore, in San Francisco, in Boston became slums, and so they said, well, just tear the slums down, put a highway through,
right.
Everybody wins. And it turns out that people said, no, we don't want that. In some cases, they said, go right ahead. So,
Well, so you're absolutely spot on that the car sharing services have a place, but it is not the be all end all. Maybe the Uber or driverless cars or other things. But I also wanted to dive quickly stop in Munich here. A couple weeks ago, the CEO of Volkswagen and Mercedes got together and called for fellow automakers to establish separate platforms for data to avoid handing over sensitive customer information to Google. So the Volkswagen CEO said, we seek connection to Google's data systems, but we still want to be the masters of our own cars.
Mm-hmm.
Potential conflict arises around making data available. And then the Mercedes CEO says, Google tries to accompany people throughout their day to generate data and use that data for economic gain. It's
right.
At that point where a conflict with Google seems pre-programmed.
Yep,
this
inevitable.
Is where we need to negotiate, which I found that to be naive. But anyway.
it is somewhat naive because we you know, I always say that once software is injected into an industry or a product, then the power and hence economic value shifts to the software writers. And this is a profound claim, and it's one that I think may also be rooted in a deeper explanation, which is that software itself is a redefinition of the value of the product, and therefore of the way it becomes modular, that you can separate the value from the manufacturer of the product, and so that separation was what computers went through, and then music went through, and then telecom went through, and now I believe that the transportation sector is going to go through the same thing, and so once you have a modularization, again I use the language of software injection, which I think is a symptom of modularization. Let's put it that way. Once that happens, then those who wanted to benefit from the manufacture of cars can no longer do so. And that's exactly the IBM stories. That those who benefited from the manufacturing of computers could no longer do so once the software was possible
value
to be
shifted.
Once the software, which is the valuable bit, was able to be taken out of. Now still the debate would be on transportation, would be how it does software make the product more valuable, and is that what customers hire it to do? Again, for music, it happened because the value of music came to be other than listening to it precisely for what's being played. It was more like I'm hiring it to do background things, or I'm hiring it to create motivation and to create isolation and to create other things rather than I want to listen to that artist and sit on my couch and focus on it. That just went away, or it's very rare anyway. So again, transfer of value into the delivery of it and into the packaging of it, into the discovery of it, that happened. Again, same with telecommunications. It went from being, I need to communicate data to another person. It came to be something completely different. It came to be messaging, which is, although a communication, it's more like it was broken into smaller pieces. It was it was time shifted. It was about entertainment rather than just information transfer. And so all of these things became enabled through software, and then that's where the value would be condensing. So the question on the car is the transportation part, which, as we established, is no longer, although is important, is not the only thing, is that as you go through things like dealing with congestion and sitting in traffic, and more people will say, look, it's inescapable that I'm going to be spending so much time in a car. I therefore want to use that time productively. And so that's why, actually, partly why podcasts such as this are becoming more and more popular as a form of content, because it's perfect for a captive audience. So all you folks listening, thank you. Enjoy the drive, both hands on the wheel. So that's the thing, is that the product is shifting. So radio guys couldn't really make a dent in the car business because radio was not powerful enough, but as increasingly people might want to do things in the car, we'll see. It's still the thinking is shifting, right? We started this show as a series long ago because we thought, how does software injection change the value of the car? Will we see more and more of that value in the car be as an accessory to a device? And I'm going back and forth. There's forces that keep the car business alive. Some of it regulatory, some of it simply because there are safety issues and so on. But there are still this, how might the software injection change the business? And so this is going to be an ongoing discussion. Part of it, again, when you look at it through the lens of Uber, and let me just step one more step back temporarily, and that's, if you look at the hospitality industry, meaning hotels. Hotels were where for many years Clay looked at that and said, there's no potential disruption happening here because there's no technological core. In other words, there was no injection of technology into the hotel business, which would allow an entrant to sort of compete asymmetrically. Right. So this is why Holiday Inn did not disrupt, coming in at the low end, did not disrupt Hilton. Hilton stuck around and is doing fine. In fact, Hilton could probably create sub brands and go down market just as well as Holiday Inn. As Holiday Inn goes up market. Same thing with Marriott. Marriott can go up and down the chain, and everybody seems to do that with abandon. Now, the point was that, why is that happening? And that seems to be a contradiction of the theory. Well, because there's no technological core, but with Airbnb allowed technology finally to enter into the hospitality, and it entered not through the operations of a hotel, but through the booking of it. So mostly the question of how do I find a place to stay got answered, and they found an alternative to the brick and mortar business that exists. So for the same reason, Uber is interesting. So both cases are software entering at the point of entry that makes sense for it. It's not
customer experience.
So Uber is not about getting the car's engine to be software enabled, or even the production system. When software entered engine management, it was sustaining. When software entered production systems, it was sustaining. When software is entering perhaps even the entertainment system, it might be sustaining. We don't know. But when it entered into the question of allocating driving and solving certain problems about getting a ride.
From here to there, sure.
Getting a ride. Yeah. And so when you get to multimodal, and this is another thing the Germans are leading on, is the idea is that you turn on your app and you say, what would it cost and how much time would it take for me to go from A to B using A, yeah, or
bus,
one,
train, bike,
but yeah, public transportation, walk, yeah, walking,
taxi,
Uber, taxi, or my own car.
Right, right.
And you actually have, you're sitting at home with those five options. Think about that. That really is a possibility.
CityMapper app is somewhat close to that now, and I think five or six cities. But I want to, we've been going for a while, but I want to close and set up maybe the next ASIM car by wondering whether Winterkorn and Zesch's assertion that they can, together with other car makers, pool their talents and therefore increase their leverage vis-a-vis Google and others. Those things never seem to work. But
I don't think so either. I think that it's like Apple Pay. if the software guys come in, you can't fight them with software. You know,
right.
you can't say we'll do a better job because you know we'll kludge something up. I think you've got to be playing it like jujitsu and sort of like let that come in.
Play chess, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, use the energy that they're bringing. First, don't stand in the way. Secondly, use them to potentially cause them to trip or fall rather than yeah. It's a delicate discussion because often you really don't have that option.
No.
it's definitely a worthless idea to go in and try to fight them. I think the only benefit of doing that might be to get a better negotiation out of any deal.
Well, that's what Zesch is asserting, that this will allow, Winterkorn said, that'll boost our position in working with Google. Well, I don't know about that.
it's an interesting negotiation tactic, right. But that's about all I can think of. And maybe I think they're too wise to fall for it.
Well,
anyway,
good,
that's a good way to end it.
Continue next time.